2FM.
Thanks for the Johnny's. It's Wednesday, the 5th of April, and this is Game On. Coming up today, Conan Byrne and Fergal Brennan are with us to discuss all of the Premier League action. Michael Corcoran will preview Leinster and Leicester. Plus, Greg Allen is at the Masters. If you want to get in touch, please text us on 51552 or tweet at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Welcome along. Conan Byrne is with me in studio. Fergal Brennan is on the line, and we're going to get straight into the football. And we're going to start with Chelsea and Liverpool last night. And to be fair, Conan, it was an anticipated game between those two teams for many reasons. One, because Chelsea are in search of a new manager. Liverpool and Chelsea both are looking for European football next week. But neither team put on a display that suggested that they were in any need of points.
No, and do we have to talk about the game? it was a poor watch. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Chelsea probably would have said they deserved their victory if the goal had been counted in for Kai Havertz's goal in the second half, where it came back up off his arm. But having said that, it was a really poor game. Obviously, Liverpool chopped and changed their starting lineup, probably in anticipation for the Arsenal game at the weekend, whereas Chelsea, they probably just wanted that clean sheet just to get, and try and get a goal just to, I don't know, ease the burden over the last number of weeks and just try and get points on the board. And it was just a really disappointing game for the spectacle that it could have been.
Yeah, I think that's it exactly. Fergal Brennan, just from what people wanted out of the game, a Tuesday night game, you think that it's going to bring something, and neither team really looked like they were up to much at all.
No, I'd agree completely. And I think we kind of got a little bit of a mini demonstration of the main issues that both teams are experiencing this season. Chelsea, for all of the money that they've spent and all of the fantastic attacking additions that they've made to the squad, they still don't score enough goals, or they certainly don't make enough of the chances that they create. And then for Liverpool, it was a similar story that we've seen in the last couple of weeks from them, which is just a lack of intensity and a lack of cohesion. And I think particularly with Klopp and what he tries to do with Liverpool, he always wants them to be competitive in terms of winning individual battles and making sure that they don't get overrun in certain areas of the pitch. And that was the case last night. I know, obviously, as Conan mentioned, they made changes and they looked to give a couple of squad players a bit of a chance to maybe impress and maybe say, I deserve to be here next season and I want to have a role in this team. And nothing really clicked in that sense. I don't think either manager came away with any sort of great amount of positivity or learning a great deal about their team. Obviously, Bruno is very unlikely to be in his role too much longer. But it was very drab. And both of these teams, as you say, are still in the running to make it for Europe at the end of the season. And it looks difficult. Liverpool in 8th, Chelsea in 11th. I know they do have more experience than the teams above them in terms of qualifying for the Champions League. But in terms of form, it's very unlikely that both of them will make it.
Fergal, let's just have a chat about Jurgen Klopp for a minute, because he is starting to be asked quite a lot now about his future because of the departures in the big clubs around him. He did say during the week that he feels it's his past success that's keeping him where he is. Do you think that it's realistic to think that he could depart or that he could be removed anytime soon, or is he quite safe?
I think he's pretty safe. And I think I don't think he was deliberately being tongue-in-cheek saying that it's his past success that's the only factor keeping him in his job. It is a factor, of course, but also Liverpool are not in the situation that, what are we now, 12 managerial sackings or 13 managerial sackings this season, and the majority of them are bottom half clubs, teams battling against relegation. I think from Liverpool's perspective, they know that he's a crucial Jenga block in the tower. If he was to leave, or if he was to be removed, as you say, from his position, it'd put Liverpool in a really delicate position, because despite their struggles and despite the fact that we've not really seen the Liverpool that we're used to this season, Jurgen Klopp still remains the key figure at the club, more important than any of the players, more important than almost anyone connected with the playing side of Liverpool Football Club. So, no, I don't think he's in any immediate danger. And I think in terms of what he's been saying in the last couple of weeks, he is confident that this summer, hopefully, from his mindset, they will qualify for Europe, whether that's Champions League or the Europa League. But he does have plans this summer, and I think that will probably be decisive in terms of whether he completes his contract all the way until 2026. If the ownership are serious and they give him £150 to £200 million to spend this summer and they're able to invest in the squad in the areas that he wants to, then we'll see a different picture next season. And I think something that's very important is quite a few Liverpool players will be leaving this summer, and that's a lot of wages being shifted. Roberto Firmino, Naby Keita, James Milner is a strong possibility. There might even be one or two sales as well. That will remove a huge amount of wages, and alongside the transfer budget that Klopp can work with. So I think certainly in terms of next season, I don't think there's any sort of danger. But if it doesn't click into gear as he would expect for next season, then we could be having a different conversation in, say, 9 months' time.
Conan, he's eighth on the table. He's quite a bit of work to do to get to that, those top four positions. Tottenham are in fourth on 50 points. United fifth on 50 points as well.
Yeah, look, on the result itself, I think it's a good point for Liverpool, considering the players that they had out on the pitch. You have Curtis Jones and Jordan Henderson and Fabinho midfield. Fabinho has been the shadow of his former self in the last couple of years at Liverpool. You have Tsimikas and Gomez at fullback, and you're up against the likes of N'Golo Kante, who's come back in, who's an excellent midfielder, who was brilliant yesterday. Enzo Fernandez, most expensive midfielder ever. Kovacic as well, who done really, really well. Probably should have scored when he went around. Alisson and Kanate did really, really well to recover. So I think Klopp would be happy with the point at Stamford Bridge yesterday, but it's just the inconsistency all season, Marie. Obviously the poor defeat at Manchester City at the weekend, going out of the Champions League to Real Madrid, the 1-0 defeat at Bournemouth as well after that fantastic 7-0 win over Manchester United. So it's just the inconsistency that probably is undermines what Liverpool have achieved over the last number of years. So they need just to get back in the straight and narrow now, and coming up they have a very, very important fixture at home to Arsenal and away to Leeds then the following weekend. So it's it's a very important time for Liverpool, but I completely agree with Fergal. Klopp is the main man at Liverpool, and whatever Liverpool should do, it shouldn't be the manager's job that kind of vacates that position. Klopp shouldn't be going anywhere.
Yeah, I'll leave that to the other clubs maybe to be at that. Just on Chelsea as well, Conan, like, seeing, I thought maybe when Potter left there would be more of a reaction, or there would be at least some sort of an effort from the players to show that it wasn't them, it was him, or, you know, some sort of a reaction that you often see when a manager leaves. We might never get a true picture of the relationship between Potter and his players, but they were as bad as they always were last night.
Yeah, as Fergal said again, they're just not scoring enough goals. Mm. Like, they have the quality in the team. I thought Reece James was very good, and Ben Chilwell and wingbacks, they were good. And Enzo Fernandez, as I said, he plays that midfield position really, really well. Joe Felix is starting to kind of do a little bit more in games, but you're not going to, like, Havertz and Felix, they're not going to score 15, 20 goals a year. I know Aubameyang's on the periphery, he's not getting a look in, but he scores goals. What, like, obviously Potter didn't fancy him, why not give him a chance in a game like yesterday at Anfield? But yeah, it's a tough job for whoever comes in. Obviously Nagelsmann is the front runner for the job. Luis Enrique obviously has come in now and has supposedly done a huge presentation to the Chelsea owners and the Chelsea board to try and get in there as well. So he wants the job. Lampard was at the game last night. There's talk about him coming to the end of the season, which would be absolute shambles if that happens. But is it a poison chalice? We've seen the amount of managers that Chelsea have had, 14 since 2007, and taken Carlo Ancelotti out of them. There's only been three managers in that space of time after leaving Chelsea that have been successful in terms of winning a domestic league. So is it a poison chalice, this Chelsea job as well?
Well, Fergal, is it? And look, let's talk about that in the context of Graham Potter and how his career or his future career will be affected by taking that job.
I think we've started to see, in terms of Graham Potter, and Alan and I have discussed this quite a few times, particularly on the Friday show, which is Graham Potter for me is probably that gap between a fantastic coach and a good manager without being a great manager. I think he's got all of the basic tools there to be an excellent coach, and he will, and I don't want to sound negative towards him because there's huge amounts of positivity surrounding him, and so there should be. But managing Chelsea and managing any top club, any Champions League club, is a completely different beast to many, many other Premier League jobs. It really is. You have to deal with a multitude of issues that you just don't face at other teams. And Chelsea is probably the biggest example of that, because it's a club that, based on the amount of money, previously with Abramovich and now obviously with Todd Boehly, success, trophies, titles are demanded, not requested, or, you know, where there's patience or time given. It's a case of, we expect you to win, and now. And that just isn't really the kind of way that Graham Potter operates. He likes to have a team that evolves. He likes to develop players. He likes to get his stamp on things in terms of coaching. I don't think it was a well-made match from the get-go. I think it was just a case of, he was doing very well at Brighton. It was a big opportunity for him to take and, you know, boost his own career, which is more than fair enough. But it never sat right, because Chelsea is a very unique beast in the Premier League, and the type of manager that they need, obviously we look back at Ancelotti, Mourinho, those types of characters that have just this huge amount of experience at winning, at coming into clubs that are almost the finished article and just putting that last piece of the jigsaw in place of, I'm the boss, you're not going to argue with my CV, this is how we're doing it, this is how we get things done. Graham Potter, unfortunately for him, was never in a position to be able to do that in a dressing room where they broke a Premier League transfer record last summer under Thomas Tuchel, and then broke it again in January under him. So I just think at so many various points, it was never going to work. And I did think maybe they'd just kind of trudge along until the end of the season just to save face a little bit. That's obviously not the case. And now in terms of managers that are going to come in, it's a very difficult balancing act, because it is maybe not a poison chalice, but certainly a difficult job to take over. And if a manager comes in now permanently, they are already under pressure to meet an objective of getting into the Champions League, maybe getting to the final of this season's Champions League, when most of the big hitters will probably want to come in the summer, have a full pre-season, have a budget to work with. So I think we could see quite a few interims between now and the end of the season, because most of the number one objectives that these clubs want, the managers are in a position to say, do you know what? I'd rather come in the summer, not have this baggage and this hangover, and let's just start afresh from June onwards.
Conan, it's hard to believe that a team like Chelsea can have broken transfer records and still not have someone that can regularly score goals.
Yeah, well, they tried with Aubameyang, and it just didn't work for them. And look, Havertz is a very, very good number nine, but he's a bit like Firmino. He brings others into play, and he gets in the end of some chances, but he just doesn't score enough goals. You have João Felix as well, that will create chances, but I think whoever comes in the summer, that'll probably be the number one position that they'll be looking for.
Are there players like that out there? Players, yeah, like who could they even go after?
Are you looking for me to say a certain Irishman?
I absolutely am not. Looking at you to say that.
Look, there always is. There's
You put me on the spot. Fergal, you've got your finger on the pulse over there now with the transfer targets. Like, who could they even go after? And do not say Evan Ferguson.
Osimhen.
No. I don't think there's necessarily anyone within the Premier League. I think they might look slightly further afield. Goncalo Ramos at Benfica has been one that's been mentioned. And I think that's the kind of player that they need. Normally when Chelsea have done well and won titles, they've had a kind of nine, Drogba, Costa, those types of players, that all these brilliant attacking players around them that are buzzing around and creating chances, someone that is just a bit of a killer in the box that can get that 15 to 20, 20 to 25 plus, is the type of player. Ramos is just someone that springs to mind because he has been linked with a couple of moves. I think in terms of the Premier League, it's difficult to maybe see a scenario where somebody goes to Chelsea. I can't see anyone from United or City or Arsenal going. I think Harry Kane would absolutely shock everyone if he crossed London. But yeah, I think probably outside the Premier League, but it is a priority this summer. And it sounds mad when you think of the amount of money that they've spent, that they've almost forgotten. It's almost like they've walked out of the supermarket and thought, oh, I forgot to buy a goal scorer. Oh, we'll come back in January. And then they forgot again.
Yeah. That's what it feels like. Okay, we may as well move on now to Brighton and their impressive 2-0 win over Bournemouth last night. So they are now sixth on the table, which is really impressive. But I guess, look, you can't help today but be talking again about Evan Ferguson scoring their opening goal and doing so with style and just getting everybody really excited again, which I know we're not supposed to do.
No, not at all. Look, it was a superb finish. That's three times now it's been caught on film, Marie. him doing that particular type of finish. He did it for the DDSL against
I
Everton.
I saw it today. Dan McDonald tweeted from the endo.
Under 12. And then he did it. I actually was on co-commentary for the under 17 National League title win for Bohemians against Shamrock Rovers. It was his last game for Bohemians, actually, and a ball comes in from the exact same position and he flicks it into the far corner. It's a carbon copy of the one that he scored last night. But I think with just last night, it was just the way he did it. It was just Mitoma obviously putting in a fantastic ball at the second attempt, and he's kind of off balance and still manages to get it to wrap his foot around the ball. It's nearly... people are calling it a back heel. It's not a back heel. He nearly calls it a cross leg. Like, he's crossing his legs and putting it into the far corner.
I love that people are getting so exercised about it being called a back heel as well.
It's not a back heel. But look, his stock is still rising.
It is, yeah.
And it's great to see. Now, I've watched him a couple of times, and what I've loved about Evan Ferguson is his movement and his positioning. When the ball is at a certain point in the pitch, he's always in the right place. He always tries to bring others into play. His first touch is absolutely brilliant, and yeah, I just think he does the simple things when he needs to, and then in around that final third he tries things, and for an 18 year old to have the ability and confidence to do that is a breath of fresh air. And that, again, his fourth Premier League goal, the sky's the limit for him, isn't it, really?
So what do you reckon, Fergo? Does he stay, does he go? Like, what's the talk over there?
I certainly would say this summer he stays. Obviously, he signed a contract agreement to stay at Brighton. And again, the Evan Ferguson kind of bandwagon, that even in his post-match press conferences, he speaks with such maturity and such calmness, and he's very grateful to Brighton. And Roberto De Zerbi, I think, has done a brilliant job, because he's constantly being asked about him. And he's almost in a case of saying, I can't praise this young man anymore. He's been saying that he thinks he's going to go on to become one of the best players in Europe. Roberto De Zerbi is just as excited as the rest of us. He just does it in an Italian accent, so he kind of sounds a bit fancier. But I think in terms of moving away from Brighton, I don't think it would be a good idea. This is a Brighton side that are challenging for Europe. This is a Brighton that have proven to be the perfect developing ground for young players over the last few years, albeit ironically in the past under Graham Potter. He's still incredibly young in terms of his career. I don't think going to a so-called bigger club in 18 months' time would be worse for his development. I think going too early would be, because immediately there'd be focus on him. Immediately there'd be pressure on him. And I think Brighton have proven that they're more than capable of maintaining him at a Premier League level. Brighton are not a team that are down the bottom of the table fighting relegation and playing long ball stuff up to a striker that's struggling to get involved. He's a crucial player in a team with ambitions to qualify for Europe and play in a progressive way. So I don't think he will leave. I don't think he wants to leave. I don't think it's the right time for him to leave. He's 18 years of age. If his arc of development continues, there's years to speculate about where he could go. But certainly in the short to medium term, I don't think he goes anywhere.
This Brighton team, like you said, Fergal, they're pushing for a Champions League spot at the moment in time. And look at the players that they have around Evan. The World Cup winner, Alexis McAllister, in behind him, Sully March. Every time Sully March drops inside, his first thought is to find Evan. And then you have probably, arguably, the best winger in the Premier League at the moment in Mitoma on the other side. So he's learning from very, very good players, and he's only going to improve with those players around him. And that's not even mentioned Casiedo in midfield as well. So I'd agree there. He should stay at Brighton for at least another year anyway.
Yeah, and in fairness, he's such a solid family situation as well, Conan, and they have been making very considered moves for him throughout his career. They're not going to stop now.
No, and look, he's Barry, his father, is like, you see Evan in his press conference, his dad is exactly the same in terms of his manner, and I'm sure he's going to keep his feet firmly on the ground and keep his son's feet firmly on the ground going forward. And yeah, I think he's just for somebody at 18 years of age to have the maturity that he has, especially when he speaks publicly to the media, it's so refreshing.
Let's look at the bottom half of the table. There was a couple of games last night as well. Let's start with Leeds, Fergal, and getting that vital win over Nottingham Forest, moving up the table. It's so tight down there with so many teams, from 23 to 30 points. Every point now, we're in that stage where it's going to be vital to avoid the relegation.
It is. And the tightness between what could be potential safety and what could be relegation, 12th all the way down to 20th, there's 7 points in it. And given the fact that we are moving in towards the running, that's pretty crazy. I think we probably by the end of April we'll start to see a couple of teams breaking away and getting themselves safe. But aside from West Ham, generally speaking, I think everybody in that block of teams has changed managers. David Moyes is the only outlier in that. And I think every team has followed the mentality of it's not working, let's kind of get ahead of the curve, get rid of the manager that's in place, whether we bring in a long-term option or a short-term option, but something needs to change and something needs to be freshened up. And you're right, every point and definitely every 3 points on the board will be huge. Forest, who lost to Leeds last night, have come out and said that they've got no plans to sack Steve Cooper.
For now.
We all know that might not be worth the paper that it's written on in terms of the running. I think they're in danger. I do, because experience is a big thing at this point in the season, and there's teams around them that, whilst they might be down there at the moment, do have lots of experience. West Ham, Everton, I know neither of them are scoring a huge amount of goals at the moment, but they've got players that have been there, done that, got the t-shirt. And in Dyche and Moyes, they've got managers that have as well. I still think with Forest and potentially with Bournemouth, there's a kind of naivety about they want to go a bit more front foot forward, and sometimes that means they get picked off. But as it stands, it's still incredibly tight. I think we won't really get a clearer picture until the end of April.
A bit like Chelsea, I thought that Leicester, Conan, would come out and show a little bit more than they did last night as well. And to see them so close to the bottom, and a team that were so close to the top in, you know, the not so distant past as well, it's hard to believe it. Brendan Rodgers obviously gone, but I mean, when are they going to rally?
Question. It was a sickening blow last night for them as well, because Harry Barnes scores an absolutely marvellous goal where he just controls the ball with ease, long ball over the top, gets by Ashley Young, puts it into the far corner, magnificent goal. And then just as you're kind of looking to try and break and counter-attack and get that second goal, Dewsbury Hall gets his second yellow card, two yellows within 5 minutes. He was actually just going to be about to be taken off before that second yellow as well, and it puts them completely on the back foot. And then Traore then scores the winner with 3 minutes to go, another sickening blow for them. They're in awful trouble. I know Graham Potter suggested that he was asked to go back into management straight away to try and get them out of trouble. He turned that down. But on the other side of it, Aston Villa, who are absolutely flying for them, they've leapfrogged Chelsea and Liverpool over the last number of weeks, and Unai Emery nearly treble the points tally that Steven Gerrard had at the start of the season with in the same amount of games. It just goes to show the ability of him as a manager to come in. I thought Moreno at left back has been absolutely superb up and down the wing, and Ollie Watkins scoring goals, I think, is breaking records there with Aston Villa. So when he's scoring away from home, so really, really good from Aston Villa. But yeah, it's going to be so interesting to see who comes in and tries to get Leicester out of trouble.
It really will. Michael Corcoran has just joined us in studio. Michael, we were talking about Leeds there and the vital points they got with their win over Forest last night. Are you feeling confident? You're 29 points, 23 is what Southampton are at the bottom of the table. Is it going to be a mediocre season, do you reckon?
For Southampton, probably, yeah. Look, I think the lads have made the point, and have made the points really in a situation where I think by the end of April, you know, there's a pattern going to emerge. I'm talking to John Farrell, the producer outside, who's an Everton fan, so we're discussing that versus every other club as well. But certainly from a Leeds point of view, it's a huge relief after the win last night. And there are some, from a Leeds point of view, some winnable matches coming up. Like, they have Palace at home, Leicester at home in a couple of weeks' time, in 2 weeks' time. They play Bournemouth. That's away at Fulham. Without their troubled people involved there. And then you have a Liverpool match, which, like, it's incredible Leeds are going for the double. Marie, sorry about that, over Liverpool. Who would have thought that at the start of the season? But, you know, I was talking to somebody else earlier today. I know I'm here to talk about rugby, but, like, earlier this season, Leeds beat Chelsea at Ellen Road. And if you look at it now, we're still probably a third of the season to go. And between the two of them, they've had five managers already. And we're still in the same Premier League season. So, I mean, the whole thing has gone bananas.
Crazy.
Like, isn't it?
Yeah, he'll be a manager. Okay, we're going to take a break because Michael is in to talk about rugby. There are a couple of games tonight that I want to get to. United playing Brentford and West Ham playing Newcastle. We'll do that later on in the programme. Fergal, thank you so much for joining us. Conan, stay with me, though, because I do want to get to those games. But rugby coming up next. Game on 2FM. Now, welcome back. Michael Corcoran has hung around for the rugby chat. Thank you very much for that, Michael. So it is Champions Cup quarterfinals weekend. That came on us pretty quickly. And Leinster and Leicester are getting it underway on Friday night. The narrative is that it's like a foregone conclusion for Leinster. Would you subscribe to that, Michael?
I don't think it's a foregone conclusion. I do think they'll win. Leicester are a very good team. They're unbeaten in the last six matches that they've played. Like if you look at the way that England played against Ireland in the Six Nations a couple of weeks back, they were coached by Steve Borthwick, England that was, who left the Leicester job, and he had Leicester playing exactly the same way, and he's taken that game plan and blueprint and the whole thing. So they kind of tried to be kind of negative, if you understand what I mean. I think Leinster will be too good for them. Yes. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that they'll win. We'll give them that bit of respect, to be fair about it. But I think Leinster, you know, a lot of the Leinster players hadn't played before last weekend when they beat Ulster. The last time they played together was for Ireland 2 weeks before that. So, you know, it took them a while to get back into their old system, back into their own groove. And I saw them at training during the course of the week. They looked very sharp. And, you know, they didn't really play well last week, and they have a chance to play well this week, because as James Lowe said to me, you know, when they're handing out the trophy in a couple of weeks' time towards the end of May, and if Leinster aren't in the final and somebody else has gone up to collect a silver trophy that Leinster so badly covet, that will hurt like hell, to be fair about it.
It will, and I guess it really feels like this will get it underway this weekend, and then it's nearly full steam ahead. They would hope anyway to the final, but getting Friday out of the way is important. Bernard Jackman, speaking today on the RT podcast, said that the Tigers don't have the power to defeat Leinster. How big an issue is that going to be?
Well, it is an issue, and we saw that, you know, when we saw that for many years when we saw Irish teams coming up against South Africa and
Munster on Saturday.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so we've seen that. I'm not sure if it's just confined to the power. I'm not sure if they've got the guile to outwit the Leinster team that contains so many Irish internationals. So it's a combination of the whole thing, really. But, you know, all you need is one thing to go wrong during the course of a match. You know, somebody to be sent off, or, you know, a red card for something, for a high challenge or whatever. You're 15 against 14 all of a sudden. That kind of evens the whole thing up. And we saw what happened. Again, I'd go back to the way England were against Ireland, when Freddie Stewart, the fullback, was sent off. It was quite a competitive match up to that, and he's playing this weekend for Leicester. You know, now I know one is not the other, but they've Andre Pollard, the South African outside half. He's a really, really good player. He's a classy player. So I think it'd be probably a tighter game than people might imagine. I'm expecting Leinster to win that one. Yeah.
Former Munster player James Cronin will be there, and he's been out talking about how there'll be lots of Munster people up to support him.
Yeah, I see on some other radio station people were giving out about that during the course of the day today, where they were saying that all the Munster fans had turned against Leinster. James is from Highfield in Cork, and his family are still heavily involved in the club, and quite a few people from Highfield are coming up to support their mate. That's the way it would be, and that, you know, but then some historical people got the wrong end of the stick and went, oh, there's busloads of people come from Munster to come up to support Leicester against Leinster. But that's, you know, this is an imaginary kind of thing, to be fair. But they're coming up to support James Cronin, really. And I mean, that'll add to the drama of it. It's they're limiting the capacity to 27,000 people because they don't want to open the upper tier. Huge costs involved in that.
Yeah, that's why, is it?
Yeah, it's just a cost thing. I mean, in terms of stewarding, Gardaí, everything like that. Like, so they've, I think they're somewhere north of about 24,000 tickets sold at the moment, which, like, they've only got a week to sell the tickets. Yeah. That's the reality about it. So they've done a pretty remarkable job.
Johnny Sexton would be out flogging them.
No, well, he hasn't done his job properly if he has. But, like, taking into account last weekend, they played at the Aviva last weekend, there was 50,000 there, but there were 10,000... Ulster fans. Leicester have returned a huge number of their tickets. There's only about 500 of them coming over, so they're back on sale for the genuine Leinster fans who want to go. But it, like, come 8 o'clock, it'll be full. I mean, to sell 27,000 tickets in a week, I think it's pretty remarkable to them.
It is. Okay, so I know you've given us a prediction. You're confident that Leinster will win?
Leinster to win. I think it'll be Leinster to lose in the semi-final on one side of the draw. And I think on the other side, I think La Rochelle will beat Saracens. I think the Stormers might have a bit of a chance against Exeter. Exeter weren't great last weekend against Montpellier. And if there is going to be an away win, I think it might come in that game.
Okay, Michael, thank you. And since we asked Michael about football, Conan, may as well ask you about rugby as well. Are you a rugby fan?
Well, I got follow.
And you're a Leinster man.
Of course, I'm a Leinster man.
Yeah.
And as I said before on this show, I was doubles partners at tennis with Jonathan Sexton when we were younger. So
That's my claim to fame.
It's actually Sexton's claim to fame.
Yeah, so I'll be rooting for Leinster, obviously. So hopefully they'll overcome Leicester.
Brilliant, William. Anyway, I'm out of here.
Michael, thank you. We're going to take a break. Stay with us, though. Greg Allen is at the Masters. He's standing by and we'll be talking to us very shortly. And we're also going to preview tonight's Premier League games.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. We have had two games to come in the Premier League tonight. West Ham are playing Newcastle and Man United Brentford. Man United and Newcastle did play at the weekend. Newcastle earning a 2-0 win over Man United. And I was listening to the post-match, Conan, and I thought it was really interesting listening to Joe Willock and to Eddie Howe talking about the system that they play. They mentioned the word athletes on numerous occasions and the importance of having the type of athlete to play their system. And it's just quite interesting to hear that being applied to football. And I, like, obviously if you're coaching or if you're involved in the environments, I'm sure it's discussed quite regularly. But even listening to Kelly Dalglish pick up with Eddie Howe and asking her about the word athlete and how much focus they put on it, and he said it's huge that they need players that can be box to box, and having that kind of athlete and almost putting the football in seems to be what they're about.
Yeah, very, very clever line of questioning from Kelly. But yeah, absolutely. Like, I've played in teams where some players wouldn't get into a five-a-side with me mates, you know, but on a big pitch, 11-a-side, their energy levels, their mobility, getting around the pitch, breaking up play is extremely vital. You know, and that's what distinguishes, like, managers.
Yeah.
They're not always picking the 11 best players. They're picking players for positions that will be able to maintain the fitness levels that you need throughout a game, and ultimately to get the 3 points. Like, you look at that Newcastle midfield, you had Longstaff, Guimaraes and Joe Willock.
Yeah.
And those lads will just run for you.
and they talked about that, and it was like the XG and the KMs covered and all that sort of stuff, and the stats are so high from them.
Yeah, well, that's the name of the game now.
Yeah.
Stats is so important. Like, they wear their stats on their back, and everything from the smallest little detail is recorded, and managers, the sports scientists, they'll go through it with a fine tooth comb to try and get the best outcome for their players. And it's working really, really well at Newcastle United.
Yeah, and even I know we spoke about before in the past, there was a documentary on the Crystal Palace Academy, and they really focused on the sports science, and they were looking at the kids and trying to anticipate from a scientific point of view how fast they're going to be able to run, how tall they were going to be, you know, almost their fitness level. So everything came down to what they could turn into, not as footballers, but as athletes.
Yeah, because even at 13, 14, 15, you're far from the finished article. I remember when I was young, it was, if you had pace, you had a wonderful opportunity to go across the water, because that's what we did when we were younger. If you were good, you went to England. Thankfully, that's changing now. But if you had pace, you were going, and you'd wonder to yourself, like, how is he going away? Like, he doesn't score enough goals. His link-up play isn't great. But the coaches in England say is that we can work with that. He has the raw ability and talent to be able to pursue a good career here. We just need to work with him. And look, that was back then, before all the sports scientists have come involved and seen all the stats from players now. It was all about pace and power, and then kind of linking everything in after that.
So we do have, I'll be watching it now tonight when I do watch Newcastle against West Ham. Newcastle doing so well, third, like, obviously trying to secure that top four space so they can get European football, get Champions League football, and then just given the considered spending of them this year and the benefits of of being, look, I guess they didn't go and blow the bank all of the time, but they got the players in that they need to suit the system, and they are reaping the rewards now that if they can get the Champions League, can get Champions League football, that you'd have to be excited about what they can do next year, Colin.
Yeah, and like, they're on a very, very good run, 3 wins in a row, beating Manchester United 2-0 the weekend. See, Maximan was electric, really, really good. And when he has that ability, because sometimes he's hot and cold, but when he's hot, he's one of the best players in the Premier League. He's really, really good. But then, like you said there, they didn't break the bank. They have players like Jacob Murphy, who just, again, as one of those players, I should have mentioned him earlier on in terms of mobility, the energy levels that he has. Sean Longstaff coming through the ranks at Newcastle United. Dan Byrne, again, not a marquee signing by any means, but he's been absolutely tremendous at left back for Newcastle United. And like they just gel really, really well. Eddie Howe's really, really good tactically. And... yeah, they're doing, as I said, they're doing really well. I do fancy them to pick up a good result against West Ham this evening. West Ham themselves on the back of a 1-0 win against Southampton at the weekend. And yeah, I just fancy Newcastle, especially with the confidence ahead, with the last 3 in a row that they've achieved. Beating Manchester United 2-0 will give them an awful lot of confidence. Not particularly happy with the celebrations afterwards in the dressing room. They haven't won anything yet. Yeah. They like, obviously they beat Manchester United, but even Manchester United, Marie, they're not like top of the table.
Do you know what? We're going to come back to this because Greg Allen is standing by, but I think that's kind of, that's what Newcastle do. You know, these videos come out of them celebrating in the dressing rooms all the time, and it does seem a bit to be part of the culture that Eddie Howe has, that they do get that little bit excited about big results as opposed to winning anything. So maybe it's just part of the way that he coaches. But we'll get into that in a minute, because we're going to cross over to Augusta, to Greg Allen.
Yeah, Marie, very interesting sort of scenario here this week, because we've got a beautiful sunny day today, an Augusta spring-like day, which is, you know, pretty much what you hope for in a Masters. But we're going to have none of this over the 4 days of the actual Masters tournament. I'm joined here, as so often we are joined on the programme, by Doug Ferguson of Associated Press, a regular in terms of interpreting Masters. This one's an interesting one, isn't it?
It is. It's a Masters unlike any other. I'm not even sure what the top storylines are, because there is a full menu.
Yeah, okay, let's go through some of them. We actually heard the chairman of Augusta National, Fred Ridley, just a couple of hours ago here in the clubhouse, I should say the media centre, doing a press conference, where he almost handed an olive branch to the LIV players and to some degree. Or did you interpret it differently to me?
I didn't interpret it so much as an olive branch, as really a good pulse on what this is about. There were a lot of concerns back in December and January, when the LIV and the tours were really at each other's throats, saying, well, that Champions Dinner is going to be really spicy. And I think as we got closer, we recognized that the Masters is above it all. The dinner is above it all. This is about Scotty. This is about memories, things like that. And I think what Fred saw at the dinner last night, interaction, a few laughs, a few tears, was indicative that everybody's getting along fine. I think he said that the tone was good. So I don't think it was so much of an olive branch that I think everyone hopes that the noise quiets a little bit. But I think he got a sense that at the end of the day, everybody's here for one piece of clothing. Everyone's here for one goal, and that's to win the green jacket, and it doesn't matter where they play.
And it was interesting, I think, as well, in Rory McIlroy's press conference yesterday, and he obviously has been at the vanguard of a lot of anti-LIV sentiment with regard to how I think a lot of players, and certainly he as chairman of the Players Advisory Committee, felt that last year's LIV assault on the PGA Tour was basically, you know, something which had to be repelled. And he was even saying that let's park that for this particular week and let's play the golf. And that's out of respect for the Masters, and which is what this tournament is. But there are 8 former Masters champions now playing on the LIV Tour who are playing here, and 12 other players who have qualified from the LIV Tour. It's 20% or more of the field, so it's a huge LIV presence by any standards.
There's no question there's a LIV presence. And I don't think you get a sense when you walk onto the range, you know, Rory and Brooks playing a practice round yesterday, and you've seen Kevin Kisner and Dustin Johnson, longtime friends. These are the things that bring a small degree of normalcy back to Masters Week. But I don't think there's a single fan, a single media person, frankly, a single player who in the names and the numbers next to him go up on the leaderboard tomorrow, you're going to ask, oh, LIV guy. Oh, that's a tour guy. You're not just going to look at a name, you're going to look at an allegiance. And I think we saw that, frankly, Greg, in Dubai this year. Rory goes on to win. Patrick was there. But there was
Patrick Reed, this is a very, very serious live player.
I forgot I'm talking to the Irish. Patrick Reed, the American.
Patrick is popular enough Irish name.
I'm sure we want him in America either, but that's another story. But it wasn't just those two. There was the leaderboard for about an hour left to go in the tournament was populated with a mixture of tour and live players, and that was the biggest buzz. I don't see how the Masters is going to be any difference in terms of how it's perceived by the people watching from home.
Okay. All of that aside, the Masters is going to start unfolding tomorrow. The weather for the 4 days, very, very difficult to predict how it's going to affect the tournament. But we do know there's going to be a lot of rain. Saturday looks terrible in terms of, 90% chance of rain, 25 mile an hour winds, temperatures down around 12 degrees centigrade, low 50s here, Fahrenheit. The weather in Augusta, it's going to come from the northeast, that wind, and it does seriously affect how this golf course plays.
It is. I was talking to a few green jackets on Tuesday who were already talking about Monday. In terms
the dreaded
of,
Monday finish. 40 years we haven't had one of those.
I wasn't counting, but yeah, the dreaded Monday finish. And a lot of it had to do with wind, actually, more than rain. So we'll see. But we are in for a wild week across the board. I mean, the great thing to me is that Tiger Woods is playing again, and given his condition, that's always cause for hope, for celebration. And I'm not sure anyone's talking about him as much as they normally would, because there's just so much else going on.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? You see Tiger still with that very flat-footed walk that he has, but he's still getting that ball speed out to 180 miles an hour, which is as good as a lot of the young fellows are managing out there. So he remains a serious competitor if he can get his walking, boots on him for 4 days. Hopefully he makes the cuts. Is Tiger a real contender, do you think?
I don't think he is, but that's the first time I've ever said something like this, and I'd like to be able to retract it. But the only reason I say that is for so many years, he's made it really difficult to doubt him, because he's done so many surprising things. But you have to be practical here. This is only his fourth tournament against the elite competition since we watched him hobble off a year ago. He's only played once this year. He's never a threat whenever he plays. It's nice to see him play, and it's remarkable that when he's made the cut, which he's done all but once at the Open at St. Andrews, is the only time he didn't make the cut. But when you look at Scottie Scheffler, and when you look at Rory, and when you look at John Rahm, and I could go through a long list of names, and you ask themselves, can this guy beat them? And the answer is most probably no. That was one of the things I asked him in his press conference. He's played with so many younger kids, and even people his age over the years at the Masters, and they've always looked at Tiger. This is the guy. I can't imagine any of them see him as a roadblock to them winning the Masters.
You know, I actually see something slightly differently, because if you go flick back through the Masters history book and you see that Gary Player in 1978 at 42 years of age hadn't won on tour for 4 years and he won the Masters. Nicklaus since 86, I don't think he'd won for nearly 6 years or something like that. Something horrific anyway, in terms of the length of period of time, and he won the Masters. There's something about Augusta, the course and distance, the familiarity of the turf under your feet, knowing that a lot of the players are hugely daunted by it, and Tiger isn't daunted by the actual challenge, and that works to his advantage, which might negate some of the physical disadvantage.
I would agree, and the two names that stand out to me are Fred Couples and Bernhard Langer. Even though they're not going to win this week either, I'm pretty certain. The fact that over the years, I mean, Fred can show up. Bernhard showed up, I think it was 3, 4, 5 years ago. Got within, I don't know, 4 or 5 of the lead on a Saturday, and you're thinking, how does he do it? The reason he does it is because he knows the course. He's comfortable. You just know your way around this place. And when you've won 5 green jackets and you're Tiger Woods, you really know your way around this place. So I think that's why you can say, don't rule it out completely, but it is unlikely.
Okay, so we're 6 minutes into this conversation and we haven't mentioned the words Rory McIlroy, which is on the not just the tips of the tongues of every Irish journalist here and Irish fan here, and there are plenty of them. Seen a few Offaly jerseys out there supporting Shane Lowry. But Rory McIlroy, if he should win on Sunday, with all the heartache that he's had around here since the 2011 collapse, last year finishing runner-up with that exultant finish, the holing out of a bunker shot on 18 to run into second place, never really had a chance of winning it. Should he win on Sunday, though, it would be an emotionally huge high point and very good for the PGA Tour as well in their profile, because it's a huge story in the making.
It really is. I think I thought it was nice when Rory kind of acknowledged, and I'm sure he's known this before, I've heard so much conversation over the years of, if Rory didn't win early, not to worry. He's not only going to win a green jacket, he's going to win several of them. And for Rory to acknowledge, yes, they said that too about Greg Norman. He mentioned Ernie Els. I always think of David Duval as another example of someone you were certain was going to win at least one Masters by the time they were done. You still have to go get it. And the thing that concerns me historically, nothing about Rory's form because it's really tip shape right now. Historically, this is his 15th Masters. And only two players have played the Masters this many times before they first won. O'Meara won in his 15th and Sergio won in his 19th. So I think the thing with Augusta that makes it so difficult and different from the other majors is that while you have great memories here and you have great course knowledge, you have an awful lot of scar tissue. Every corner you turn is a memory of something that's gone wrong. It's just, that's true with everybody. And those are some of the demons you have to conquer.
It's funny, I spoke to Rory yesterday and he was saying that, like, at this point he's gone away from all of these trying to, you know, in the idea of putting Masters into context, you know, it's just another tournament. He's gone, downplaying the Masters is no longer how he's going about it. He's just accepting that it's a stressful week, it's a big week, he's got to handle it, and that he just has to really just get down and into it early, get off to a half decent start, which he often hasn't done, and just get up and running, and then treat every feeling of stress for what it is, a huge opportunity. Is that wise?
I think so, because I think sometimes he overthinks it. Oh, it means a lot, I'm going to prepare a little different this year. Oh, I'm going to act like it's not a bad... There's too much thinking about how you're supposed to either not care or not worry or whatever. Just go play. Accept. And that's the biggest thing, Greg. Accept the fact that, yeah, you're going to be tested. And you want to get to the last hour, and that's when the real test begins, to see if you have it mentally, emotionally, to be able to do it, knowing that that's coming. And he's dealt with it before in other tournaments and other majors. I think it's all about accepting and understanding I've got a road in front of me and be ready for it.
Three players have separated themselves at the top of the world rankings pretty much from the rest, and it's Rory McIlroy at number two, John Rahm at number three, who was number one only a few weeks ago. Like, they've interchanged already this year, and Scottie Scheffler, who's just had in outstanding form yet again, and he walked away with it last year. His three-shot victory, he had a four-putt on the last green, which meant it was really a four- or five-shot victory because he was walking up 18 with a great deal of comfort and upholstery on his lead. I mean, is it one of these three, do you think? Will the weather possibly throw in a scatter cushion in there of a player we might not expect?
Well, I think just golf will throw in a player that you don't expect. I mean, that's going to happen anyway. But when you start talking about favorites and expectations, you just don't stray too far from those three. And you mentioned Rahm. It's stunning to me. If you go back to the opening round he had at Bay Hill, this guy's never going to lose again. And 3 weeks later, he's number three in the world and not number one. Scheffler is interesting because, you know, we thought he was on a bit of a heater last year. You know, just everything coming together at once, and then I don't say disappears, because he didn't. He didn't win again the rest of the year. And now he's doing it again. And frankly, if you look at this 2023 calendar, his worst finish is 12th in seven tournaments. He is a proper player. He's got game. Obviously, he's got game. I think he's a gamer is what I mean. He just knows how to sniff it, how to get it done. He's got the length. He's got the marvelous short game. He can't be discounted. But we look at those three because they've been rotating the number one position, and rightly so by their winning. But there's still a collection of guys right behind him. The other Irishman that we don't talk about, Patrick Cantlay. I know he was born in Los Angeles, but we have a lot of Irish in this country. He's a guy that has no real weakness, doesn't win as much as it looks like he should. He's sneakily rounding into perfect form, as is his buddy Shoffley. And then you just go right down the list. Spieth gets a lot of attention because, frankly, when Spieth is on decent form, his name on the leaderboard means more than other players just because of his history around here. And there's probably a couple others that we're leaving out. I don't know that weather affects it that much. I just think Augusta affects it that much.
Okay, one word. Who's going to win? Who do you want to win?
You go first.
Well, obviously, I really want Rory to win, even because of the fact that so much history is in the making, and this is a big, big surprise that people want me to want Rory to win. But I would be very happy if Seamus Power or Shane Lowry won, and obviously our amateur here is hopefully going to get the amateur medal, which hasn't been won for a few years, Matt McLean. But you?
I would like to see Rory win. I think Rahm is going to win. The one name we didn't mention in a very positive note, I think you should look for, is Patrick Reed, because whenever controversy slams down on this guy is when he plays his best. I mean, if there's a big live versus the tours moment, and people are watching, Patrick's going to show up.
Doug Ferguson of Associated Press, thanks so much for joining us here on Game On, and back to you, Marie.
Thanks so much, Greg. I think I'll agree with Greg there and hope that Rory McIlroy does win. It'd be nice to see Rory in that green jacket for sure. Okay, it's time to turn our attention to swimming now and join John Kenny at the Irish Open Swimming Championships. John.
Hey, Marie. Yeah, last day, and it's all wrapped up here. Tom Fannin, the former GB international swimmer, is now switched his allegiances to Ireland. Swam a time of 22.02 seconds for the men's 50 freestyle, just 0.05 of a second off his own Irish record. That's a time that's under consideration for the summer's World Championships in Japan. It's the third time this week that Fannin has dropped under the A consideration time for the 50 free, and the amount of Irish swimmers who've done similar now stands at 7 for the Fukuoka meet earlier or later on this year. Very successful week indeed for the Irish squad. Also with an Irish senior record in the final women's race of the day as Victoria Caddison dipped below her own best time set at the Europeans in Rome last year, recording a gold medal winning time of 1:59.74 seconds, cutting 0.12 of a second off the time she set in 2022. But Mona McSharry, the big news of the week, she wrapped up the treble of 50, 100 and 200 open titles here at the NAC, the final session of races, as McSharry was just outside the Irish record in winning 2:25.70 to take her third gold medal of the week. And this is what she had to say afterwards about that 200 win.
Honestly, that race felt better than this morning's one. It was about 2 seconds faster, or a second and a half. So I think I'm just going to take that as it comes. And it's all information for when I have to go fast.
You talked to me earlier week about how you apply yourself to races like, say, the 50, which is a fun event, gives you a chance to grab the water. Then the 100, 200 is not your event, but 100 is the main one for you, though, isn't it?
I'd like to think the 100 and the 200 are both equally as important in my head. The 200 is more of a mental game than anything. I think the 100, it's a lot easier to just get out there and race, but with the 200, I'm fighting some demons a little sometimes. But no, I'm trying to focus on both of them equally, because I think they can both be really good for me at the Olympics.
Sure. What's the plan now for the next, what have we got, 500 days of the Olympics and 100 days of the Worlds? Back to Tennessee, is it?
Yeah, back to Tennessee for a couple of weeks and then home here to train until Worlds. Have some time at home just to recuperate before we've got the big Olympic year, and then yeah, just head down, training hard for the year.
Now, thanks so much to John Kenny as well out at the NAC, and for all of his reporting during the week. Very quickly, Conan, just before we go, a very quick word on Man United Brentford.
Yeah, going to be very good. I think it's going to be a very good game. I think the next three games for Manchester United are going to be so important to get 9 points. They have Brentford, Everton and Nottingham Forest. Martial back as well. Good goal scoring form when he's been available. But look, they have to bounce back from that lacklustre display against Newcastle. Poor in the first half, even worse in the second half. Don't think Nick Pope had a save to make, and they're up against now Brentford, where they were destroyed earlier on in the season, that 4-0 scoreline. They've up against Tony and the pace of Mbeumo, the set piece specialists in Brentford, and Brentford have won defeat in their last 17 Premier League games, and that was against Everton. So look, Manchester United bounce back. They need to bounce back. And I think they will bounce back.
Okay, and we're going to bounce out of here, Conan Byrne. Thank you so much for joining us. Shane will be here tomorrow. Betty De Silva's up next.
RTE 2FM.